So I'd like to start the talk tonight just by forgive me if in any way I sound politically sectarian. It's really really important for us to be inclusive and welcoming of people of all political opinions. But it occurred to me this week that I just remembered that after the general election in 2004, I came out of a sabbatical 2 days after the election to offer a talk on taking refuge after the election. And I just it just occurred to me that I didn't feel that I needed to do that in 2008. And I just want to share a little bit of Dharma gossip with you. A fellow Vipassana teacher sent me an email today saying that when he took the oath of office, Barack Obama had one of those white scarves in his pocket from the Dalai Lama. I don't know if that's true, but it's just a nice thought. So I have prepared a kind of a gnarly talk for tonight. It's kind of more Dharma 303 than Dharma 101. But I actually want to start, even at the risk of, or at the certainty of not completing this talk, finishing this talk, I wanted to start with something simpler, something that has happened to me just in the last 24 hours. I wanted to share it with you. The Dalai Lama actually gives gnarly talks too. I once went to a lecture where he described the 13 different kinds of emptiness. But he also says, again and again and again, my religion is kindness. And this is more has to do with what I'd like to share with you now has more to do with that latter simplicity. Yesterday I had an appointment. I live up basically between Española and Taos. And yesterday I had an appointment in Taos. And as I was driving toward Taos, I saw walking in the opposite direction an older African-American man with a big pack on his back. And 4 hours later, as I was driving home, many miles further on, I saw him walking again. He wasn't hitchhiking. He was walking on the left side of the road. And for those of you who know that road, it was in the middle of the gorge, a very dark place. So I stopped and I asked if he wanted a ride. And it was a few miles from my home, long enough for me to get some sense of who he was, just a bit of a sense. And I asked him where he was going. He said, Albuquerque. And I said, it's a long walk to Albuquerque. It was dark and it was cold. And I said, it's about 112 miles from here to the outskirts. So when we got to the turnoff to my home, I said, you know, I'm going to Albuquerque tomorrow. Would you like to stay at my place tonight? And he accepted that invitation. Very well-spoken person, very taciturn, didn't speak very much. We never had a conversation. I offered him the basic needs, a bit of shelter, a bit of warmth, some food, a place to bathe. And so he spent the night in my new yurt, which is the guest space for my mobile home. It's not perfect in the winter. The yurt is basically a glorified tent. It doesn't have any insulation in the walls. So while there's a fire going in the wood stove, it's warm. But it's a small wood stove, and the fire goes out in 3 or 4 hours. And then the temperature in the yurt kind of equalizes with the temperature outside. So it probably got down to 20 at my home last night. But I piled him under a whole bunch of blankets and down and gave him a ride, made him some lunch and gave him some snacks and gave him a ride into Albuquerque today. When we were having breakfast, it just occurred to me as I was taking my medication that keeps down blood pressure, that this blood pressure medication probably, almost certainly, is prolonging my life. and realizing that he may very well not have access. He's about my age, a little younger. He may very well not have access to that simple, inexpensive medication because of the way this society is constituted and the way healthcare is done in the society. So when I dropped him off in Albuquerque today, he's on his way to Houston. I asked him if he needed some money to get to Houston, and he said, no, I think I've got enough. And I pressed a little bit, and he very politely refused. It was a powerful experience for me, and I just want to share a couple of reflections about that experience. One is it just remembering, actually the Buddha came up with almost the same list of hierarchy of needs that Abraham Maslow came up with. And essentially both Maslow and the Buddha are saying that unless people's essential needs are taken care of, you know, for food and clothing and shelter and medicine, unless the basic needs are taken care of, it's very difficult to have a spiritual practice. It's not impossible, and certainly people who are very challenged in those ways, whose needs aren't fully met, do have spiritual practice, but it's hard. The other thought the other reflection that I've had is that, you know, I would not advise you to take the risk that I took. And I think especially if you're a woman, it would be just about impossible to take that risk with a stranger. It is a risk bringing a stranger into your home. For me, it was a question of balancing kindness and compassion and generosity, balancing that with discriminating wisdom. I got a real clear sense of his character before I invited him into my home. And if I hadn't had a clear sense, if I hadn't felt that he was trustworthy, I wouldn't have left him out on the road. I probably would have driven him into Española and dropped him off at a shelter. He had spent the previous night at a shelter in Taos. And I gave him a list of shelters in Albuquerque in case he was here in town tonight. So it's that question of sort of balancing with discriminating wisdom, with some kind of understanding of the conditions. But I was glad that I took that risk personally. It just occurred to me that, you know, I stretched myself a little bit in that situation. And I was glad that I stretched myself. And it seems to me that one of the things that keeps us from being compassionate or kind in any given situation is fear. Sometimes it's a very reasonable fear, but sometimes it isn't. You know, and we have to make that judgment. And then just briefly, kind of looking at the other end of things, recently I led a residential retreat, meditation retreat, and I co-led it with a fellow teacher, and we had a number of people who were doing really deep and beautiful and fruitful practice in that retreat. But we also had kind of an unusual proportion of people who were not doing deep practice and weren't particularly interested in doing deep practice. A couple of them said to me, I'm here more for R&R than I am for meditation. And one person was, I appreciate the candor. And one of them actually came to an interview and started the interview by saying, this is a good day because it's a good hair day. And I really support, we support. I support people to get their R&R, and I support people to be happy if they're having a good hair day. But my fellow teacher and I were also clear that these people, even if they didn't know it, were essentially throwing down a $20 bill and picking up a nickel in terms of the immense, extraordinary value of really undertaking spiritual practice. And my co-teacher and I remembered Herbert Marcuse, decades ago, saying, if people are surrounded, all of the people, actually, who were sort of not really turning their attention much to the meditation practice in this residential retreat, all of them were relatively wealthy people. And Herbert Marcuse said, when people are surrounded by comfort, it's hard for them to turn toward pain. And so it seems like, you know, there's the disadvantage of not having your basic needs met, and that being a big challenge in terms of taking on spiritual practice. It's not impossible. And there's also the challenge of being so well off that you can essentially wad yourself with comfort so that you don't have to turn toward pain, either your own pain or the pain of others. That also is a disadvantage. And again, it's only a generalization because there are certainly wonderful exceptions to that. Richard Gere being one of them. He can afford any kind of comfort he wants. And he's a very serious spiritual practitioner. So it seems like in some ways the middle class is best off for in terms of having the conditions, the right conditions for spiritual practice. You know, basic needs are met, but not enough wealth so that you're totally wadded with comfort. It's just a reflection. Yeah.
Your mic's not turned on.
Oh, it isn't. Okay, I thought I turned it on. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Oh, I've got it on standby. Okay, is that better?
Yeah.
Can everyone hear? I hope people heard what.
Can you repeat that, please?
So, to get to the gnarly talk here, there's. Dogen Zenji of the 13th century, who was of the Common Era, who was the founder of Soto Zen Buddhist tradition, said something that has just fascinated me since the first time I read it. He said, the awakened mind is intimate with all things. It is intimate with all things. You know, there are some things that are easy for us to be intimate with, but imagine being able to come up to and to touch with intimacy, all of your experience, and not only your personal experience, but also our society's experience and our global experience. You know, have you been intimate with the situation in Israel and Palestine in the last couple of weeks or few weeks? So, you know, one way to define intimacy, and this is just my own particular definition, is intimacy is the experience of presence and connection when the sense of self is weakened or isn't present at all. When we're so connected that sense of separation is either diminished or abolished. It happens all the time in this practice. You know, not to make it sound too woo-woo. For example, sound is heard. In the moment of hearing, the moment of clear mindfulness, the only thing that is happening is that there's a sound and it's known. In that moment, there's only the sound and it's known. In the next moment, thought may come in and bring in all kinds of concepts and projections and abstractions. Eric rang the bell and I heard it. In the moment of hearing, there is no Eric, there is no bell, and there is no I. All that gets superimposed later to the bare experience. In that moment of clear hearing, there's intimacy. And there's no sense of self and other. That's why the Buddha said that every moment of clear mindfulness is a moment of nirvana. It's a moment of absolute freedom. That's why being present and being aware of our experience again and again, moment by moment by moment, by being fully present, by being intimate with our experience, is so liberating. Even though these things happen so quickly that we don't really acknowledge their power. But there's a great power happening. So most of the time in the Dharma, we talk about how to be intimate with difficult experience. You know, the those Buddhists, they're forever talking about suffering. And there's a good reason for that. That's part of our experience that's most difficult for us to be intimate with, without resistance, for example. But tonight, I'd actually like to talk about liberating intimacy with pleasant experience, just for the heck of it. And because I'm not going to be able to finish this talk or even come close to it, I just want to share with you, the Buddha, not only did he give a hierarchy of needs, he loved lists. He taught by lists, and they're actually quite marvelous because it's such a succinct and clear way of describing reality. Not only did he give a list of the hierarchy of needs, he actually gave another list, and it's a hierarchical list of kinds of happiness. And starting with the most common, and what he says is the least fulfilling and the least important, the one we all know, the happiness of sense pleasure. And since I'm not going to be able to get through the whole list here, let me see if I can just give you the list, and maybe I'll finish this when I come back next month. But there's the happiness of sense pleasure, the lowest form of happiness. And then there's the happiness of ethical conduct, the happiness that comes from self-respect, the self-respect that comes when we make an effort to be helpful and not to harm. And then a whole list of things that come essentially from meditative practice or spiritual practice, states of consciousness that are increasingly more subtle and the Buddha said more satisfying. So the happiness of calm, of tranquility, of peace, the happiness of concentration, of having a mind that is unified and one-pointed. And with deepening concentration, the happiness of rapture, of joyous interest in our experience, and a subtler form of happiness, of bliss, and the happiness of equanimity, the happiness of mindfulness, the happiness of insight, and then finally, the Buddha said, the very greatest happiness of all is the happiness of nirvana, of touching the unconditioned, that which is not born and does not die. So I just wanted to give you that list because we're not going to get too far along. just get some sense of what the ground is here. So the happiness of sense pleasures, and I think it's very important for us to distinguish pleasure, which sometimes gets a bad rap in the Buddhist world, the pleasant experience, from the grasping and clinging that can follow a pleasant experience. So what we in our society say about pleasure is that it transports us. And Webster defines to transport to carry away with strong or intensely pleasurable emotion. To carry away. So I guess my question is exactly what gets carried away when we're transported by pleasure? And I'm going to argue, you know, the psychologists and the philosophers might discuss that question forever. I think that those of us who do this practice might have some clear sense. Maybe it's the self that's carried away, the sense of self that gets carried away in the moment of pleasant experience. So if you would, think of a particularly transporting sight that you have seen in your life, maybe a spectacular sunset or the first time you saw the Grand Canyon or some painting that moved you profoundly or sculpture, whatever. Or think of some music, the hearing, some music that has transported you, that has carried you away. Or some aroma, or some amazing food of taste, of smell and taste, of some powerful physical sensation that has transported you like a memorable orgasm. Or transporting ideas. You know, for intellectuals, there can be a transporting pleasure in ideas. I think if we can be clear enough and aware enough at the moment of contact, the intimate moment of presence and connection, we discover that the transporting experience when the sense is when the sense of self is diminished and falls away. And there's this in that moment of intimacy. Let's say that this is pleasant. This is pleasant. It may or may not be pleasant to you, this sound, but let's just for the time being say it might be pleasant. In the moment of intimacy, as I said, there's no sense of self. So I just want to follow this. Again, this is gnarly, forgive me. And I want to talk just very briefly about a subject that whenever I bring it up, I see people's eyes glaze over. And that is the 12 steps of dependent origination. Now, doesn't that sound exciting? Does that idea transport you as soon as you hear about it? I just very briefly, I want to talk about 7 of the 12 steps. And this is the Buddha basically, with amazing analysis, showing us precisely how we create our suffering. Each step dependent on the one before it. And this is how we create our suffering, this is how we prolong our suffering. And so when conception happens for us, and in the process of gestation, we essentially come up with a mind and a body. A mind-body. And when the mind-body is forming, we create, as it were, or we develop, as it were, the sense doors. The ear, the eyes, the nose, the tongue, the capacity for physical sensation, and awareness of what is happening, the mind door, the capacity to know thought and feeling, for example, and awareness itself. So there's a mind-body, one step, that gives rise to sense doors, and once the sense doors are there, there can be contact through the sense doors. Contact. And then what is associated with every moment of contact is what we call feeling. The experience is pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And that feeling gives rise to craving, which gives rise to clinging, which gives rise to a quality of becoming or the ongoing quality of existence. So you have an experience. If it's pleasant, the inclination is to grasp and to cling. If it's unpleasant, let's suppose, oh my God, if this is unpleasant, is he going to keep bringing that? You know, if it's unpleasant, wanting to get rid of it. So it's really important for us to be able to distinguish pleasure, the pleasure of the experience, if this is pleasant, from the grasping and clinging that follow it. Does this make sense? Is this totally off the wall for you? It's the grasping and clinging can really mask that quality of pleasure. So we can be equally intimate with grasping and clinging, but that's for another talk. In this talk, I want to focus specifically on our intimate experience of happiness, the pleasure that can come through our senses. The moment of pleasure is not a problem if it doesn't give rise to the grasping and clinging. And it's right there in the whole thing of dependent origination. Most of these links are involuntary. But what we do is we train ourselves to notice the experience, the sound, to notice the feeling, pleasant. And if we're clear enough, we don't have to go to grasping and clinging. That's where freedom comes from. We are changing our relationship to what is happening. So if we can enjoy pleasure without grasping, the pleasure can be liberating. This is not a common Buddhist, in common idea in Buddhism, precisely because in that moment of intimate contact, self is attenuated or doesn't appear at all. Maybe what we get addicted to is not the pleasure itself, but the moments of freedom from the prison of self that pleasure brings us. If that's true, then every addiction is at heart a yearning to be free. And I mentioned in the talks that I did a few months ago, I mentioned that in Tantra, they say that all desire seeks two things, unity and satisfaction. And that's equally true of the desire for pleasure and the desire for freedom, for liberation. So there's the happiness of sense pleasure. The Buddha said that a deeper form of happiness comes from what we sometimes call virtue. That is, of really making an effort. It's so much of ethical conduct is so much a foundation of our practice. The Buddha taught generosity and ethical conduct first before he taught people meditation practice. It's the self-appreciation that comes from helping and not harming, the sense of self-respect. And in that sense of self-appreciation, we're not necessarily creating an identity around it. There can be some way, the Buddha said, celebrate your good deeds. It's not egotistical, actually. It brings joy to our hearts when we celebrate what is good. I celebrated helping Andre, the man that I picked up on the road last night. But, of course, we can create an identity around it. I am a virtuous person. If you happen to know the Enneagram, I'm a type one, and we're big on being virtuous people. and it just reminds me of in Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, there's the line, Sir Toby Belch says to Malvolio, "Do you think because you are virtuous there will be no more cakes and ale?" But so we can create an identity around this, but we don't have to. There's a beautiful thing that happens if you just notice the next time you're feeling love or compassion towards someone. There's a beautiful thing that happens. If you pay close attention to it, there's in that moment of deep loving or deep compassion or deep kindness or deep generosity, in that moment, there's not such a sense of separation from another. The walls fall away. And that is a moment of beauty and happiness. The happiness of kindness. So the Buddha talked about other forms of happiness that come from essentially doing spiritual practice or doing meditation practice, and in each case, we liberate our intimacy with these forms of happiness by distinguishing the pleasure involved, how pleasant it is to us, from the grasping and clinging that can follow it. That's the whole trick. With happiness, with forms of happiness. You know what? You can have that chocolate mousse. just in terms of sense pleasures, you can have that chocolate mousse. There's no problem in having the chocolate mousse. The only problem comes when there's that, I want more. Do you see? If it's possible for us to just enjoy the either the grosser pleasures of sense happiness or the subtler kinds of happiness that I'm describing, we can absolutely enjoy these things as long as this doesn't happen afterward. So calm, tranquility, peace. The Buddha said that this comes from essentially purifying our minds through meditation, through prayer. It can be from the garden variety of calm, which we all know, which we have all experienced, to the profoundest kinds of unshakable peace. Here's the Buddha . Imagine having this level of peace. The person who is unstained by attachment is refreshed and free and has entered the ideal state of nirvana, is always at peace. That person is free from all attachments, has removed all suffering from the heart, is tranquil in mind, and is always at peace. So the happiness of calm, of tranquility, that can actually deepen to the most profound, unshakable peace. So, we can feel the happiness of calm. We have all experienced that. Isn't it better to be calm than to be anxious? We've all experienced it. We've all valued it. It's just to notice that when that calm morphs into something else, like, say, anxiety, whether there's that thought, I want the calm back. I want this calm to stay. It won't ever stay. It's impermanent until we get to that level where it's absolutely unshakable. So it's just to enjoy the happiness of it and then to notice if there's this grasping for what is pleasant, because it's very pleasant. That quality of calm or peace is more refined and more beautiful and more satisfying than the most gratifying sense pleasure, the happiness of sense pleasure. So as calm deepens, there's the experience of a concentrated mind, a mind that has been drawn together and is unified. There's a sense of wholeness, there's a sense of lightness. Often there's a sense of inner radiance that comes, and a sense of boundlessness that comes with a concentrated mind. It's real nice. It's one-pointed. It's a happiness purer and more satisfying than many other kinds of happiness. So I can't tell you how many times I've watched this mind and have worked with so many other minds who say, oh, that concentration is wonderful. Where did it go? I want it back. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like again and again and again, people leave a retreat and they call me and they say, I feel horrible because the concentration didn't last. That's where the suffering comes from, do you see? By wanting to prolong the happiness rather than just allowing the happiness to happen and then to pass away when it passes away. And then as concentration deepens, the sense of calm and concentration become very deep, inevitably what happens is that rapture comes. It's this quality of joyous delight in our experience. We've all had rapturous experiences. You may have had a rapturous experience in response to a beautiful piece of music or some wonderful sexual experience. I will never forget the rapture that I felt the first time I saw the Grand Canyon. I almost walked into it not knowing it was there. And so all of a sudden the ground disappeared. And it was this... So we've all had that quality of joy. It's specifically, the Buddha said, an antidote for ill will. And And it doesn't appear just in Buddhism. None of these things appear just in Buddhism. Calm and the self-respect from ethical conduct. And you know, you may have seen these wonderful pictures of Saint Teresa, the Spanish mystic of the 16th century, I think. Is that right? Saint Teresa in rapture, you know, with her eyes kind of rolled up and just this amazing radiant expression on her face. It happens. And the Buddha described these. It's just I just find this absolutely delightful. But the Buddha describes five. Of course, there's a list. Five kinds of rapture. Minor rapture is only able to raise the hairs on the body. Momentary rapture is like flashes of lightning at different moments. Third, showering happiness breaks over the body again and again like waves on the seashore. Uplifting happiness can be powerful enough to levitate the body and make it spring up into the air. It's wonderful. Oh, it's just so wonderful. Uplifting happiness. And uplifting rapture. And then the fifth and most powerful form of rapture is when pervading rapture arises. The whole body is completely pervaded, like a filled bladder, like a rock cavern invaded by a huge inundation. Nice. It's real nice. Rapture is good. And this can come to us by purifying. Essentially, it comes from the purification of our consciousness. When rapture's there, it is impossible to be bored. It's just absolutely impossible because everything is interesting. It's really quite wonderful. And we can enjoy this happiness until, you know, we grasp for it and we want it to stay because it's impermanent. Is the point getting through? So I'm just going to do one or two more. So then there's what happens actually is concentration deepens yet more. Rapture has kind of an excited quality, and that sort of disturbs the calm a little bit. And so what happens is concentration deepens more. There's bliss, which is an amazing and beautiful quality of happiness. It's very calm, but it's so sweet. Bliss is really quite wonderful. And we can enjoy that. We can enjoy the rapture. We can enjoy the bliss. It's true that meditators sometimes get blissed out. And they suffer if they want it to last, if they want it to continue, if they want their bliss back. And then the Buddha said, maybe I will be able to finish this if I rush through it. Then the Buddha said that one of the most extraordinary forms of happiness is the happiness of equanimity. And it is yet more refined. The quality of equanimity is very calm and extraordinarily stable. And if our suffering comes from our reaching for what is pleasant and our pushing against what is unpleasant, you feel the way the mind gets off balance. The equanimous mind does not reach and it doesn't push. It allows all experience to come and go, simply to come and go. Let it be. Let it be is sort of a beautiful expression of equanimity. We know it from the Beatles, and the Beatles got it from Hamlet. So be it. When the quality of equanimity is really strong in the mind, when the mind has been purified to that degree, and I know, as I look around the room, I know there are some people in this room who have experienced very deep equanimity. It's the image that comes to my mind is that the mind becomes like a mountain of diamond. It's extraordinarily stable, and yet it's brilliant. It's luminously brilliant. And then the Buddha said that even more powerful and beautiful and refined and satisfying then even equanimity is the happiness of awareness itself, the extraordinary clarity and purity of awareness. And again, we all know about being aware, but it can be taken to immense depths, where you come to understand that there is no limit to awareness, that we don't generate actually awareness. It's all things in the universe arise in awareness and disappear into awareness. They arise out of it and disappear into it. And then finally, the happiness, the extraordinary happiness of experiencing what we call the unconditioned, of nirvana, or in Pali, nibbana. It's of experiencing that which is not subject to suffering, which is not subject to conditions. It's unconditional. It's experiencing that which was never born and cannot die and has no limitations. And you actually come to experience directly for yourself that not only is this a reality, but it's actually what we are. And there's an extraordinary change of attitude, or change of response, or change of relationship to experience that happens from coming to that understanding. You know, my sense is that that in the deistic religions, this experience of the unconditioned is what is called God. It can be experienced directly. And in our tradition, we don't personify it. We don't turn it into a someone. We come to understand that it is the ground of being. It is our essential being. It is impossible for us to conceive, after having experienced it, that God or whatever you want to call it, the essence of being, is everywhere but here. God is omnipresent. So this experience brings tremendous happiness. And if I brought it, there's a beautiful statement. I didn't bring it. The Buddha talking about the particular happiness or joy and peace of nirvana, luminous. And all of these things, essentially, we can mess up by clinging to them. And so people mess things up by clinging to their equanimity, their mindfulness, their insight, and even nirvana. We can be intimate with these things. In that moment of intimacy, with each moment of intimacy, that we escape the prison of self. That sense of the boundary falls away. And there's this profound sense of connection, and that brings enormous, an enormous sense of well-being. But we get attached, and so in the Zen tradition, I love that they're just so wonderful and direct. In the Zen tradition, they talk about the stench of enlightenment, and I've watched it in my friends. It's like somebody who's had the experience of what we call emptiness, of this essence of our being, whatever you want to call it, the unconditioned nirvana. Suddenly everything is empty. I have a friend who had a really profound experience, a really dear friend of mine, profound experience. And for at least a couple of years afterward, he sounded like a talking textbook. And I kept thinking, when is he going to get real again? You know, so there's this kind of attachment that happens. And we have to kind of work ourselves away from the, believe it or not, from the attachment to nirvana. there's the gross expression of it. If you ever hear someone say, "I'm enlightened," turn around and find the nearest exit as fast as you can. So that's the grossest expression. I'm an enlightened being. The subtler expression of it is the sense of it's all empty. You know, it's all empty. And that can be really dangerous. So again, Buddha Dharma, who is kind of the great grandfather of Zen, who tend to do everything in a really extreme way, uses this really extreme language. Buddha Dharma says, anyone who experiences emptiness and ignores the law of cause and effect is condemned to everlasting pitch black hell. So you got to pay attention to cause and effect, even if it's all empty, even if it's a dream, even if it's, you know. So the beauty of the Heart Sutra in the Mahayana tradition, it begins with the words, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. There is no form other than emptiness and no emptiness other than form. I know that's gnarly sounding too. But essentially, most of us in this world are attached to form because we don't know anything else. There's a me and there's a you and there's an it. You know, and then some people have the experience of emptiness after, sometimes spontaneously, sometimes after a lot of spiritual practice. They have the experience of emptiness, and they can get really attached to that. It's all empty. And what the Heart Sutra is telling us is that they're not separate. And so we integrate. We come to respect both levels of reality, and we're able to move smoothly between the two. It takes some time. So just, if it's appropriate, the trick with all of these forms of happiness is to notice the moment of intimacy with all of them. Notice that if you're deeply present in the instant of happiness, the moment of happiness, even so simple as hearing a lovely sound, there's some sense in that instant of being free from the tight little prison cell of self. It's really important to notice that. And then notice if there's a tendency to want more. That wanting enhances and solidifies the sense of self. So there can be this moment of selflessness followed instantly, if there's grasping and clinging, followed instantly by the enhancement, the solidification of the sense of separation and self. It's all... it's all very subtle, but it's really worth paying attention to. To know that we can enjoy what brings us happiness, and then simply knowing to let it go. So the Buddha says, so simple, but so beautiful. He says, nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. No matter how refined and beautiful and spiritual it may be. Nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. Whoever has heard this truth has heard all the Dharma, all the teaching, all the liberating practice. Whoever practices this truth has practiced all the Dharma. Whoever realizes this truth has realized all the Dharma. So that's my hope for us all. My hope for us all is that we can enjoy every form of happiness that the Buddha describes. From the common form of and grosser form of sense pleasure, which we all know, that form of happiness, to the happiness of nirvana, to the happiness of unconditioned freedom. And my hope is that all of us will learn to have these experiences and to let them go, not to cling to them. If you allow all things to arise and pass, you won't suffer. It's that simple. So thank you for your patience.